The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
If I am not mistaken, last time we got together, we spoke about Lo Tirtzach, about murder, and a little bit about character assassination. I think I told you the story of the most bizarre suicide, if I'm not mistaken. And so this time we get to the next mitzvah. It's interesting that these debrot, they're all like two words. They're quick shots. There's no long discussion. Almost as if to say that this is not a complex idea. And the truth is, if I had to pick, you know, of the Aseret HaDibrot, we're getting into the realm of those that are most challenging. You know, most people listen until they get into the question of murder, you know. Certainly, ostensibly, most people don't struggle with that commandment. Okay, so you get into the question of character assassination and whether you can embarrass someone. The Mishnah says, "Hamalbin pnei chaveru b'rabim." If a person whitens another person's face, it's tantamount to murder. You're removing their identity. Adultery, however, is challenging on a different level, because we live in a society that has hacked away at this principle probably for the last 50 years. And you get to the point where you struggle with exactly what's wrong. And I want you to know, you know, because this is one of those topics that we kind of gloss over when the kids are young. You don't really want to talk about it so much at the Shabbos table. In the end, it's one of the Aseret HaDibrot. It's a fascinating thing to have a discussion with high school students and to ask high school students what's wrong with adultery and to see what they say. You've got a significant percentage of students, at least in my experience, that will tell you that they think it's wrong. But when they get down to being able to defend it, it's not so simple. So let's take the extreme case, right? I'm not talking about the guy who, I don't know, works as the cantor in the synagogue and, you know, sees some 15-year-old walking into the shul. That's not what I'm talking about. Couple number one is unfortunately miserable. And they're not happy for a variety of reasons. They've given up on making their marriage work for a variety of reasons. I'm putting aside for the moment sort of how long a discussion that should be, just to get to the point, right? And they're miserable, but they're not contemplating divorce. Reason they're not contemplating divorce, I'd be amazed if there's anyone in this room who hasn't met someone struggling with this question at some point. Reason they're not contemplating divorce? Kids, right? Can't do it to the kids. That, by the way, is a very difficult question. And it's always interesting to me that couples, before they, you know, if they're not sort of able to get counseling or therapy or do therapy within themselves or whatever it may be, that the assumption is always so natural that it's better for the kids to stay in an unhappy marriage than to leave an unhappy marriage. That's not a simple question in either direction. But let's say that's the case. Couple number one. Couple number two lives around the corner. Same situation. Miserable, not happy, not fulfilled, right? Everybody here goes to the movies once in a while. You watch television, you read the newspapers, and you know that there's supposed to be that love and feeling, and it's just not there anymore. You're just, you know, you're not waking up in the morning and making jokes over that first cup of coffee, and you don't have those little giggles anymore. And every time you wake up in the morning and you go through it again, and it's depressing. Depressing not to be in a relationship that fulfills you. So, husband number one meets wife number two. And maybe it starts out innocently, you know, it doesn't have to be a movie. You know, the movies enjoy drama. And the way drama works, you know, I once heard this from Rabbi Aaron, who had the privilege of studying a little bit with Kirk Douglas, who told him once, you know, drama always has to be sharp contrast. They'll never tell the guy that his mother died, God forbid, as he's sitting alone in a dark study, brooding over the fact that he's losing his business. They'll wait until it's his 50th birthday party, and just as they're bringing out the cake and everybody else surprised, someone will hand them an envelope. Because that's drama, right? The contrast. So this doesn't have to be drama. It starts very innocently. And you realize after, I don't know, a bunch of Shabbos meals that these two families spend together, or whatever it might be, that you're falling in love. Now the question becomes, well, so what's so terrible? I mean, let's say wife number one and husband number two are in miserable marriages, but they want to stay in their marriages for the kids. And by the way, there's no evil plot here. They're doing it for good reasons. And let's say that they, you know, it hasn't, God forbid, you know, sort of degenerated into something negative. It's just, you know, it's not positive enough. And let's say that wife number one and husband number two actually fall in love with each other and find fulfillment with each other. And let's say that husband number one and wife number two, it doesn't matter if you remember the numbers, you get the point, right? They never find out about it. They never find out about it. So here's husband number one. He's in a marriage, he's not happy. And now he's found someone with whom to share his pain. And wife number two, she's in a marriage, not happy. Now think about this. If he's now finding someone with whom to share his pain, so he's going to be happier. If he's going to be happier, he'll be a better husband. He'll certainly be a better father because he'll be happy. So what's the only gray sort of spot in this silver lining? Is guilt, because you're not supposed to do this. So what if it was okay? What's so terrible? This is, I want you to know, the essential question of Lo Tinav. What is so terrible about adultery? Nobody can leave the room at this point, okay?
Adultery is different now than it probably used to be. Because adultery, there was, I mean, well, at least for a man, it was different. Well, it's different for a man. Huh?
This woman is married.
No, I'm just saying, like, so a man can marry a lot of women. Well, are you saying because she's with
that? Well, that's why I'm choosing the prime case. Okay, by choosing the prime case, you know, Eshet Ish. It's interesting, by the way, maybe we'll get to this. Rashi talks about the fact that Niuf is only with an Eshet Ish. There are other issues. There are other, you know, there are different types of relationships. We have lots of relationships we can't have, right? But this particular one, which is the sort of the Av, the father of all the relationships that are problematic, is with a married woman, right? So what's the problem with this? You hear the question, right? Now, I want you to know, Hollywood says this is great. Think about this. This guy is cheating on his wife because he loves his children. He doesn't want to leave her. I realize I'm being devil's advocate here. He doesn't want to leave her because she's never done anything terrible. He's just not in love with her. So he's miserable. She's not in love with him. She's miserable. Maybe they've talked about it. So let's say they know. Listen, in the 1970s, I remember when I was in high school, they opened up this club up the block from our house, one of these swinging single, or not singles. And I forget what they called it, but it was the place you didn't walk by on Shabbos. You know what I mean? And of course it was owned by a Jew. And it was open Friday nights, right? And basically this place, they had ads. It was like a swapping place. People would come. Yeah, right? Couples would come, and they would, you know, that's what you would do. You would want a little excitement in your life, so you would go to this club, and you would meet someone from someone else's marriage. Everybody would agree. It's just all free. Not hurting anybody, right? This was a big thing in America. Let's agree that pshat is, okay, that this is, I mean, this is as adulterous as it gets. Because the act of adultery does not actually have anything to do with whether the partner knows or doesn't know. That's just a Hollywood addition. Right? I mean, we feel more troubled by it. Certainly there's an additional deception that's a separate issue, that's sheker, there are issues. So what's the problem? And I want you to know that the root of this problem, relates to many other mitzvot. This couple is experiencing whatever they're experiencing. They're struggling with whatever they're struggling. They don't want their kids to be miserable. You know, children of divorce are going to always have a certain amount of pain. Right? So I'm putting aside that question. And now they're becoming happier people, both of them. Let's say the husband and the wife both find someone that they find fulfillment with. So you hear the question. Okay. It goes without saying there's something wrong with it. If you remember when we first started these discussions, we had a brief discussion about the fact that you can only begin to study Torah when you start from a certain perspective. In other words, you have to know what perspective you're coming from. If this book was written by a brilliant group of individuals, so you can still study it, it's just a book, but you're studying a book. But if you're studying Torah, then it's a question of sort of whether this is not just wisdom or truth. So I agree with you, we're starting with a certain premise, and the premise is that the truism that we're dealing with, which comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is that you can't do this. Now the question is why? What exactly is this issue? And I want you to understand that there's a root to this question, because this relates to many other mitzvot. You know, the premise of this question is that if it makes me feel better, or, because that's easy to put down, if it makes other people feel better, if it makes everyone feel better, of course, we're going to end up debating that, right? But if it ends up making everybody feel better, then it has to be good. If it makes you feel good, it has to be good. This is the same question that someone will have with, I don't know, kashrut. You know, I remember when there was a, what was it called? I don't even remember the name. I think it was a Mars bar. There was a type of candy bar that went in and out of kashrut a few times when I was a kid. Or Juicy Fruit Gum. Juicy Fruit Gum when I was growing up was kosher. Now it's not kosher, right? Right? And, you know, it's especially challenging because, you know, you always wonder whether the issue is really the kashrut,
right,
or whether there's some mashgiach who's not getting paid or whatever it may be. You know, and the Yetzirah has lots of ways to make things kosher, right? What could be bad about Juicy Fruit Gum? Makes me feel good. I'm going to chew it while I'm learning Torah. It's going to elevate my experience. What, you know, pigs are dropping dead all over the country. I mean, what's the big deal? It makes me feel good. What's the big deal? Why does Judaism want... And I want you to know this is an underlying premise. And it comes from a society and from a media that suggests that it's important to feel good. Now, that happens to be true. Of course, the question becomes, how do I define what feeling good really is? The premise of this question is that this couple deserves to be happy. The children deserves to be happy. That also happens to be true. But of course, the question is, what is happiness? And how does this work? So, I think it's worth separating two issues, you know? And maybe just taking a look at this mitzvah on a different level. On the level of a relationship, just as an aside, you know, to think about this, Unkelus says a fascinating thing. Unkelus, in his words, and you have to understand, Unkelus, maybe just to give a little background, Unkelus was one of the early translations of the Torah into Aramaic. He was a ger. And all sorts of legends about Unkelus. When he became a ger, the Roman legions wanted to convert him. You know, he was apparently the son of the family of emperors of Vespasian. And he became Jewish, and this just wasn't done in those days. And every time they sent soldiers to bring him back, he would get into a conversation with these soldiers, and they would all end up converting. It's a famous, you know, whatever, breita, right? And this translation, you know, one of the mistakes that we make with translation is just, we assume we're reading it, but we're reading it in a different language. But we're not. We're actually, obviously, a translation is a commentary, because someone looks at the words and tells you what he thinks they mean. So Unkelus is a commentary from the time of the Mishnah. And it was deemed to be such a critical, such an important commentary that goes on the page. And there used to be a time that they would read this commentary every day, or rather every Shabbat when they read the Torah. Which means that the Tanaim, the authors of the Mishnah, believed that this was the commentary. So it puts a whole different spin on how valuable understanding this commentary is. So listen to this. This was so telling. And it's always worth, when you learn, to take a look at Unkelus. There's a little dictionary. It's called a Jastrow. Marcus Jastrow basically created a dictionary in Aramaic. And anyone who sort of gets into studying Talmud and Gemara and whatever, you know, whenever you come across a word which is a noun, which is difficult, so you can look it up in the Jastrow, right? So if you ever want to sort of once in a while go through Aramaic, use the Jastrow dictionary, you will come up with just fascinating commentaries. And this is no exception to the rule. Because what does he say is lo tinaf? Lo teguf. Now what is guf? In modern Hebrew, gufani is physical. So lo tinaf, what we call don't adulter, would be, I guess by Unkelus's translation, imagine that the word physical was not an adjective but a verb. Don't physical. That's what Unkelus says this is. So what does that mean? And by the way, Rashi says here very clearly that lo tinaf ein niuf ela be'eshet ish. Adultery is only with a married woman. And there's a whole separate discussion here, which I'm not going to get to right now. But if a person has a relationship with a woman who is not married, that's a different prohibition. That's not adultery. Now that is very telling, and it sort of raises the question of what adultery really is and how it works. And I'm telling you in advance, because I know our time frame, that there's a certain side of this question that we are definitely not going to get to today, because you can only get to so much, but it is a question worth discussing, which has to do with the Torah's relationships and the different perspectives of woman and man. That's a very important discussion. We're not going to get to that today, but don't worry, we will. So what is this? What does it mean that you can't have an affair because it's physical. And what does that say about a relationship is meant to be? So I guess in order to do this, we have to come back to sort of review, you know, because I never know who was in which class and when we discussed what. These topics have definitely come up, but maybe just to put them in order vis-a-vis this particular dibra, because there are two understandings that we have to have. One is, what is marriage, right? And the other is, what is love? Now, if you could pick a word that would be the basic word that defines what marriage is. In other words, two people meet and they come to you and say, do you think we should get married? Right? So what do you want to know? What do they need to have? I mean, I would venture to say, and it's very interesting, you know, you go to the, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu worked it out, that we were down here in Florida, and that I was sort of regularly visiting New York, instead of being in New York and not having to visit, but being there all the time, I sometimes think it was just an opportunity to appreciate the challenges of New York. You can only appreciate things when you step away from them. And it's like you go into this, you know, it's like visiting Disneyland every once in a while, you know? Or in this case, it's more the Haunted House of Horrors, but okay, right? And you go in there, and you have a whole different experience, and you see a very different reality. Then you come out, and you look around and say, how did that happen? And this is a perfect example of this, you know? Because there is a single scene on New York City, you know, for young, or not so young anymore, you know, sort of frum, whatever that word means, Jewish couples, or not Jewish couples, but Jewish singles, which is just incredibly challenging. And, you know, you meet people who are extremely talented, fine individuals, they're attractive, et cetera, et cetera, and they just can't seem to get married. And the more you get into conversations with these people, the more you start to realize what the essential issue is. I have this theory that, you know, when you're 20 or 23 or 25 and you get married, you're too young and dumb to know better. You are. You know, you get married. I mean, there's no other way to put it. You're just, you don't know any better. So you don't have the ability. Yeah, great. My wife's going to hear this tape, right? You really do. You have this sort of, you know, what's so complicated?
A little lack of wisdom.
Right? Yeah. If you would go back now, right? I mean, if you would go back now, knowing everything that you know to get married, it would be much more difficult to get married. Because you would have a lot of questions. You know, when I was, I don't know, whatever it was, 25 years old, I wasn't thinking, to be honest, about what kind of a mother Dorit would be. Because it's a ridiculous question. Who can even think that way? You're 25 years old, you're a couple years out of the army. Motherhood? I'm just, you know, does she cook? You know what I mean? Motherhood, right? Who thinks that far, right? Right? You talk to someone who's 40 years old, who's been single for 20 years, right? And they've got lists. They've got lists. It's unbelievable. To me, it's very simple. If you think about it, it's a simple list that you need to have. It's very complicated how to develop it. You really only need three things. You need to be able to trust someone. You need to respect them, which is really part of trust, right? You need to share the same goals, and you need to be willing to work. What am I missing? Love, right? Am I missing love? Okay, so this is the illusion I want to shatter. Do you have to love someone before you marry them?
You have to feel like an attraction.
Attraction comes and goes.
But the attraction when you meet them, 20 years later, it's like a committed.
I mean, if the person is not treating you well,
look at how the Orthodox couples get together. They spend how many hours? You could count hours. But how much time? And they sit down, they discuss their goals. They figure, you know, they determine. Right away, I think the chemistry will determine whether or not there's an element of trust and respect. And I think that chemistry, as opposed to like attraction per se, and the fact that they're headed in the right direction and they want to work together and do it. And then they get together after they've met 3-4 times and they get married. And then they go out and look, you know, and then they're just focused. They have focused common things. And I think through that's how they build up their love. Like
right,
they build
that's
up
how
a
you
love.
Build love.
Right. Because if you define love, you know, I love this guy, you're 17. I love him. And I was like, what was that?
So here's the question. So think about this. It used to be that when a couple got married, there were two stages to marriage. There was what was called erusin, and then there was what was called nisuin. Erusin is something that we call engagement. It's really closer to betrothal. Okay? And nisuin was marriage. So we'll call them betrothal and marriage just to make it easy for everybody, right? Why did we stop? In fact, today they have a ceremony which sort of reminds us of, right, of betrothal, which is called tanaim. A tanai is a condition. The way tanaim basically work is that a couple could become betrothed to marriage through representatives who represented them. In this case, their parents. So two fathers can get together and they can decide, right, that, you know, Rachel Leah and Yaakov Dov are going to be betrothed to each other. And they would actually make tnaim. They would make a contract. And this contract, people don't realize this when they do this ceremony sometimes at a wedding, right? The tnaim has nothing to do with the bride and the groom. The tnaim is the father or whatever, sometimes God forbid if a parent is not there, or nifter, so they or died, so they have another representative. Somebody representing the groom, let's say the father of the groom, and the father of the bride get together, and they agree that Rachel and Yaakov Dov are going to show up on the appointed day, and they're going to be married, and each father agrees to provide, and usually the father of bride has a lot more agreeing to do over there, right? And they sign it tonight. The reason we stopped doing this is because over the last, especially 100 and some odd years, this has become a much looser arrangement because of society. And according to most post-game, according to most authorities, if you, and I'm not giving you psak here, but if you sign a tanaim agreement and you break it, you most probably need a get. You need a divorce. And all sorts of questions arise, for example, if a person is, if you meet a woman and she had a tanaim and broke it off but she never got married, is a kohen allowed to marry her? And there are all sorts of discussions. And most posts say yes, but it's very complicated. And that's why there are many authorities, Rav Moshe Feinstein is an example, who were vehemently against doing tanaim. In fact, I once had a case of a couple who met, and it was an arranged marriage, or somewhat arranged, you know, and they wanted to do a vort. You know what a vort is? Where they get together and everybody gives divrei Torah just to celebrate the marriage, okay. But they decided they were going to do tanaim because it was so beautiful and they loved the custom and the mothers got there and break a plate, right? And they wanted me to do the wedding. And I said, well, here's the deal. If I do the wedding, you can't do it tanaim. And, you know, they really wanted to do this tanaim. And in the end, I convinced them and they didn't do the tanaim. And 6 months later, they broke up. And they would have had such a mess. Mayan is now 13. From a halachic perspective, she's a woman. In our house, she's still Mayan. But okay, right? So, if one of the boys in her class, okay, is smitten with her and says he wants to marry her, and she's smitten with him, right, and so she says yes, and he gives her a crackerjack ring, and they want to be married, and they get two other boys in the class who are 13, la halacha, you would be hard-pressed to find the loophole that she shouldn't be a divorcee, God forbid. So that's a very serious. This is an issue of halakha, and this agreement had certain obligations. Now, there was a time, I don't want to get too into the social issues here, there was a time when this type of an agreement made a lot of sense. You know, given society, for example, in Yemen, I once met, had the privilege to meet Rabbi Kapach, who's an amazing woman. She does unbelievable things in Yerushalayim. She has a warehouse for clothing and bride's dresses. And her husband is Rav Kapach, who translated all the famous translations of the Rambam. Anyway, she married her husband when she was 11. She was at his bar mitzvah. Why? Because in those days in Yemen, if a girl was not married after a certain age, she was in a lot of danger. So I'm not saying there aren't reasons for this. But Rav Moshe says, since minhag avotenu b'yadenu, when you have a custom, the custom being to fulfill this halacha, right? So you shouldn't just let it go. So therefore, if you want to do it right before the chuppah. Now, I bring this all up for one reason. What was this concept of tanaim, of erusin? And what was the concept of nisuin? What was betrothal and what was marriage? So it's very interesting. When a couple got betrothed, and there are different opinions as to what tanaim does this, but certainly erusin does. When a couple became betrothed, they were not yet permitted to each other. They were not married. Okay? However, pardon? Betrothed is like engaged, but it has legal implications. Okay? You know, today, let's say a guy is dating a girl. And then he meets another girl, and he goes out with her on a date. Right? So, the first girl feels terrible. But in today's society, this other guy, he hasn't really done anything that wrong. He's dating her, he sees another girl, he goes on a date. Happens all the time in the movies, right? He's still dating this girl, he goes after that girl, right? Nothing wrong. What about if they're engaged? So if they're engaged today, it's just a little not nicer. You know, it's a little worse. But there's nothing wrong. That's what I'm saying. I'm not talking about our perception, I'm talking about Hollywood, right? In fact, sometimes the protagonist comes off as Baruch Hashem, he found the other girl and didn't mess up, right? Now, if a person's married and he's doing that, something's wrong, right? That wasn't so then. Betrothal then was akin to marriage. She was forbidden. She was an eshet ish. She could not marry someone else while she was betrothed to this person. If you legally, in American law, become engaged to someone and then you marry someone else, you're not legally obligated to break the engagement. You're a pig if you don't give back the ring, right? I mean, and maybe not. I don't know. It depends why you break off the engagement, right? Yeah. In fact, that's a big to-do today, right? All these movie stars who get married and then they get engaged and then they don't, and what's going to happen to the ring? And Baruch Hashem, America has lots of time to deal with nonsense. Anyway, so what was Erusin? What was betrothal? What was marriage? So listen to this idea. You know, I'll tell you how I figured this out. I had a student once. I probably told you this story. I had a student once, and I could always tell. I used to run a yeshiva, and I could always tell when one of my guys had a great date. You know, because he'd be sitting there with that look, you know, sort of looking at the Gemara, but not looking at the Gemara. So I always knew, right? And usually I could tell what her name was, because he'd be doodling it on the side of the, you know, whatever it is. And these are 19-year-old boys, 20-year-old boys. And I could also always tell when one of them got dumped, right? Because they just walk in with that puppy dog look, right? Anyway, so there was a guy, he was in my yeshiva, he was like 20, you know, he was actually thinking of going for a smicha already, he was getting serious, and he had obviously met someone because he was flying, he was grinning all the time, you know. So I want to ask, you know, fine. Anyway, comes to talk to me, he's met this girl, and she's like the love of his life, and he thinks he's going to get married to her, and what do I think about him getting married, and is it worth waiting, what if his parents think he's crazy? Wait, we have this whole discussion, right? Fine. And I'm trying to slow the guy down because he's like 19 years old and he hasn't seen life yet. And I, you know, okay. So about a month later or something like that, he comes to talk to me. He's got a really serious issue. And this is a good boy. He's a good student and he's learning and he's trying to get into it. And he's actually talking about becoming a rabbi. Apparently his relationship had become very physical. And he was really struggling with it. And basically his question, to make a very long conversation short, was, I know I'm going to marry this girl. But I know I'm with the person that I'm going to marry, and I just find it very difficult. I didn't ask him what very physical meant. It wasn't my business, but he was really struggling with this. So I said, here's what I think you should do. Think about this, you know. I said, see if you can go a week without any physical relationship with this girl. Go a week without any hugging or kissing or whatever it is you're doing. 1 week. If you can't go a week without touching her, then that's an addiction. That's a whole different discussion. If you can go a week without touching her, then we'll talk after a week. I said, but here's the deal. You can't hole up in yeshiva. It doesn't mean anything that you're here in yeshiva talking on the phone. You have to go out with her every night. So this is great, right? Because your rabbi just told you can go out every night. Right? What could be better for a yeshiva boy? Fine. 4 days later, he comes to talk to me. They broke up. Why? Because his relationship had gotten so physical that the relationship hadn't developed. And when they stopped being physical, there was nothing left. Right? And they realized, no. Pardon? Didn't ask. My guess is it just became apparent, you know, right? But the point is that one of the things that we do is that we allow the physical to take the place of what the development of a relationship really is. And by the way, this fits with our original question, although not to its extreme, because I think it's deeper than that. But just as an aside, you know, you see these, I don't know, movies or books or articles or whatever it is, that a guy is miserable and he walks down the street and he sees this woman, right? And their eyes meet across the highway. And the next thing you know, they're in a hotel room. If you could have a relationship that's been around for 10 or 15 years, how could any person that you just met possibly measure up to such a relationship? It could only mean that your definition of relationship is lacking some of the basic ingredients. I mean, the reason that the process, there is a process for a person who's in an unhappy marriage, like you said before, right? It involves ending a marriage, God forbid, it involves get, and then it involves erusin, and then it involves nisuin, right? So what was erusin and what was nisuin is very interesting. Part of the problem today, you know, I met a guy who, his daughter got married, you know, late, and this fellow was really, I mean, I think he's in his 90s, and we were sitting and talking, you know, they made a l'chaim. And he was so, you know, over the moon that his daughter was getting married, and good girl, good guy. And he said, you know what the problem is? You know how we can solve the singles problem? Okay, I'm all ears. He said, they got to stop cooking for them. Now, that was a very deep line, because what he meant was that women today, or girls, or ladies, or whatever, they do so much for the guys that there's no reason for the guy to get married. And he began to expound on this theory. And in certain circles, and I'm not talking about, you know, the firm circles, it's true on every level. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're basically already living with the person, you're experiencing everything you want to experience, there's nothing left. Now that's very interesting, because what's missing, you know, what's the challenge, okay? And this brings us to the discussion of love. See, Erusin was a period of time when there was no physical relationship yet, but there was a commitment to this other person. Now that's very interesting. What's the problem? You know, I think part of the problem, when you think about it, in the way that we get married, is that if you think about what marriage really is and what love really is, you can't really know that this person is for you until you're married. So how do you decide to get married if you're only going to know when you are married? Now, what do I mean by that? So we've spoken about this before. What's the difference between love and lust? It's really very simple. Love is the word ahava, comes from the root hav, means to give. Love is all about giving. And lust is all about taking. When you love someone, you see them as a partner. And when you lust someone, you see them as an object. And that's why love grows and lust wanes, right? Now think about this. If that's really what love is about, and you know, I mean, we talked about this recently, the things that you love the most are the things that you give to the most. That's why we love our children so much, because we give them so much. That's why sometimes our children at certain ages have a hard time loving us, because they don't have that much to give us. In fact, what do you do if you want to love something and you don't love it? You give to it. You know, and I'm not talking about the extreme. It doesn't have to be that you're already in marriage therapy. But let's say just whatever. You wish that you had more love in your marriage. That's a very healthy and a normal thing. You want to elevate your marriage. So how do you do that? You do that by giving. You know, we live in a society where on certain levels people get married. The question that, the line that I hear most often when someone describes to me why they think it's not going to work out is things like, well, he doesn't do it for me. Or I need somebody who can do this for me, or I need someone who can do that for me. I need someone, you know, and sometimes that's a very legitimate point. Like, I need someone I feel is going to respect me. That's very reasonable. But that's always where it starts. And I'm not so sure that that's where it's supposed to start. Before you start to wonder whether this person has what to give to you, first you have to decide, what do I have to give to them? Because if I have a lot that I want to give to them, that's how it grows. And if they then have a lot to give to me, then that's how that grows. And that's what Ahava is. Now the example of this par excellence is the story of Yitzchak and Rivka. Yitzchak never develops his relationship with Rivka, and we've talked about this, until they're married. He doesn't even go to meet her. He doesn't pick her. Pardon? Well, that's a medrash. No, and I want you to understand. No, I want you to understand. When you see a medrash, and it's not in the pshat, in the text, what that means is, it's irrelevant to the basic crux of the story. Pardon? It's not mentioned in the Torah, it's mentioned in the Midrash. There's an idea there. That's a separate idea that has to do with how relationships develop and what relationships are. And you'll see in 60 seconds that it fits. Right? But it's not the prime issue. It's a good question, right? But Yitzchak never goes to meet Rivka. Eliezer goes to meet Rivka. In fact, when Rivka shows up, she doesn't even know who Yitzchak is. She has to ask Eliezer who he is. And when Eliezer says, that's Yitzchak, it says Vatitkas, she covers herself up because she suddenly realizes this is the guy she's going to marry. So there's a cognitive process there. She falls off her camel. Ain fatipol mi'ala gamal. And that's a whole discussion as to what that means. It relates to b'yom hi gamel Yitzchak, whatever, right? So Rivka and Yitzchak never have a relationship. In fact, what does it say? It says, v'yikach Yitzchak et Rivka, v'yiviyeh ha'oil asara, v'yeh haveh. Yitzchak takes Rivka, which in the Torah clearly means marriage. In fact, all of the laws that we learn about marriage, about Kedushin, come from two juxtapositions of that word, kicha kicha, which is the tractate of Kedushin, right? He takes her, he marries her, he brings her home, which means he begins to build a home, build a life, and only then, vayava, he loves her. Now, our image of this is that that's skewered. Imagine you meet a guy under the chuppah, okay? And you say to the guy, so you must love her very much. And he looks at you and he says, I'm gonna. So if you were the father-in-law, you'd be very nervous. But that's pshat. Which marriage? Yitzchak and Rivka? I would tend to disagree. Yitzchak and Rivka is the only marriage in the Torah, and I'll tell you why I think this, but this is a legitimate question. It's the only marriage in the Torah that does two things. It never suggests a problem in the relationship between Yitzchak and Rivka. Even after Rivka tricks Yitzchak with the brachot, with switching Yaakov and Esav, their marriage survives completely. You know what? We'll digress for a minute, because this is important. Listen to this idea, because this is important. Maybe it'll help us, because otherwise you won't understand where this is going. What's the whole story of Yaakov and Esav? There are many different ways of understanding the story. And this is a two-hour discussion, but let's put it into 90 seconds, just to put a bug in your head to think about, okay? Yitzchak, when he wants to bless, what does it say? It says, "Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav kitzayid b'fiv." Yitzchak loves Esav, because Esav is somehow some fulfillment of something that Yitzchak feels is critical to the Jewish people. Maybe Esav is something that Yitzchak isn't. He's the man of the field. Okay, whatever that is. And Rivka, right, loves Yaakov. Rivka ohevet et Yaakov. It doesn't say why Rivka loves Yaakov. Rivka has an intuition that Yitzchak doesn't have. That is, by the way, a pattern in human relations. Okay, if you ever look at a marriage that's a healthy marriage, I promise you it's because two things are happening. It's because the husband has learned to listen to his wife. I guarantee you, this is not a line. Absolutely. I so learned this the hard way. I feel like I crested a plane. No, on little things, you know, like I crested a plane and my marriage is in a different place because I just, and I look at this, I'm thinking, what great gift am I going to have to give to my children one day? Just this. If I can convince my sons to listen to their wives earlier, they'll have great marriages. That's the first. The other is, you know, sort of how the wife treats the husband, that the wife respects and loves and compliments the husband all the time. Because we're basically simple creatures, and you know. And this little finger, it's around the little finger. And that's life, fine? Okay. So Rivka has this intuition. Okay. Yitzchak gets involved with Esav. Now, who is Esav? Esav is the Ish Sadeh. He's the man of the field, hunt. On a mystical level, Esav relates to what other creature that is the creature of the field? No, where else in the Torah does it tell me that a creature or an item or a being was of the field? Only one place. The nachash hayarum mikol chayat asadeh. The nachash was, the field is the province of the nachash. Now what the nachash, the snake is, in terms of wickedness, in terms of evil, and how challenging it is to deal with good when you're out in the field, is a whole discussion of itself. What happens to Yitzchak when he's eating the food of Esav? He's eating the food of the Nachash. So on a mystical level, what's happening is that Yitzchak is becoming immersed in the world of the Nachash, of the Sadeh. That's what's happening. Yitzchak is eating the food of Esav. Now on a certain level, this is very similar to Adam eating the food from Chava. What does Rivka come and do? Rivka comes and switches the food of Esav for the food of Yaakov. And by the way, if you look at the verses, and I really wish we had time to do this, if you look at the verses there, you will see an incredible parallels between the story of Adam and Chava and the story of Rivka and Yitzchak. It's the same language, the same words repeat themselves. The Torah is making a parallel. And their Mefarshim would talk about the fact that Rivka is doing a tikkun for Yitzchak. She's doing a tikkun in the world. She's fixing something. Pardon? For Chava. But she's fixing the world of Yitzchak. Okay? So it wasn't about their relationship. It was a much bigger picture, the story of Yaakov and Esav. But what interests me is that their relationship survives. You would think that after a story like that, they would have a problem. Yaakov and Rachel, who have a very different type of relationship, you actually see a number of instances where they have a hard time. Right, Rachel wants to know why she doesn't have children, and Yaakov yells at her, "Atachat Elokim Anochi," right? Oh my God. There is strife. The Torah doesn't hide it. Even Avram and Sarah. At a certain point, Sarah laughs, and Avram has an issue, right? Whatever it might be. You never see that with Yitzchak and Rivka. So I don't know that we have to get into whose is the best marriage. But clearly the marriage of Yitzchak and Rivka is a paradigm, or one type of paradigm, for a marriage, because it works, because from Yitzchak and Rivka comes Yaakov. And because the Torah holds it up, etc., etc. So what is the pattern of the relationship of Yitzchak and Rivka? The pattern is that the love that they build comes after marriage. Now let me ask you a question. It's much easier to get married when you think you have that loving feeling before you get married. And on a certain level, that's a gift. That's a bracha. Hashem gives it to you. Hashem doesn't give it to you. But if you look back at your marriage, how much of a role does that play in whether your marriage was really successful? In other words, you know, I'm married 15 years now, right? How much of where you're at now, how much of the happiness in your home, with success in bringing your children into the world, and a healthy marriage, How much of that really has to do with where you were before you got married, and how much of that has to do with what you've done since you got married to build and to work on it? And is that building and working it really based so much on whatever feeling you had? The feeling that you have before you get married, to a large degree, I'm not saying totally, because if I'm right, and if Ahava is about giving, so there's giving that takes place before marriage. But it's not the same giving of commitment that happens in marriage. I've met couples who were weeks away from their wedding, and you sense that something's wrong, and Baruch Hashem, they break up the marriage. Happens. Sometimes it's an extreme, like a person who's going to marry someone who isn't Jewish. Sometimes it's just marrying the wrong person for you, right? Because you're not committed yet. It's not there yet. And the relationship that builds in marriage builds from a tremendous amount of work and effort. And that work and effort is accumulated over a long period of time. And that's what love really is. Now, by the way, this is a paradigm for every type of relationship of love. It's a paradigm for our relationship with each other, right? V'ahavta lo'echa kamocha. One way of understanding love your fellow as yourself is that there are therefore two types of love that you have to work on. You have to work on loving your fellow human being, and you have to work on loving yourself. So what does that mean to love yourself? First of all, who's doing the loving if the self is being loved? What is that inner dialogue? You know, is there a part of me that comes from somewhere? That's a whole other discussion. And beyond that question, what does it mean to love myself? If it's just that loving feeling, so then I either have it or I don't. If I don't, I'm stuck. I mean, think about this. If love is just about meeting someone and hearing the music, then what happens if I don't hear the music about myself? Then that's it. Life is over. But that's not what love is at all. Love is a relationship that builds. It builds as a result of effort and intense desire. It builds as a result of goals. It builds as a result of what you give. So that means that it's critical for a person to give to themselves on a healthy level. And I'm not just talking about the physical, like you give time to yourself. I'm talking about giving yourself the things that give you purpose in this world. Finding those things that have meaning, etc. And it's the same with your fellow human being. In order to have a relationship with others, you have to be willing to give. And giving, by the way, has to be in balance. And that's a whole other discussion. If you're in a marriage and one side is doing all the giving, it'll never last. The reason it'll never last is for this same idea of balance that we've spoken about before. So getting back, therefore, to niyuf, to adultery, what then is the problem with adultery, right? Is that if I can adulter, what I'm basically doing is I'm accessing a relationship that's based on taking and not on giving. Because basically, that initial question of that paradigm of the adulterous affair that one might consider would be valuable, the two miserable marriages, right? He's not interested in someone because he wants to give to her. He's interested in someone because he's missing something in his own life. And that's not where a healthy relationship starts. What do I have to give? So there's much more to talk about, obviously. We're not done with this yet. But at least as a beginning, this sort of gives us a picture as to what relationships are. And I'll just put the last thought in your head. I think, sort of, that this context has enormous messages for our children. You know, I think that we have windows where the kids are still in our, you know, sort of sphere of influence to a greater degree. And I think that you have these enormous opportunities to discuss these issues and to bring them up and, you know, Parshat Shavuot, whatever it might be. And it's fascinating to see once kids are teenagers. Again, I'm just at the abyss of discovering this. But I know with Mayan, this is a healthy discussion, you know. And it's fascinating to realize just how much society has impacted their perception to the extent that it's warped. Of what marriage is and what love is. You ask the average kid, I guarantee you, in eighth grade, and they think that love, which is something that I didn't really think about that much when I was in eighth grade, because the movies we watched were just on a different level. But they think, and even then, they think that love is a noun. They think love is something that you find. Love isn't something you find. Lust is something you find. Love is something that you build. It's a verb. That's why if you don't love someone, it's because you're not doing enough work. So you can go back to the drawing board. Sometimes you can't fix not loving someone because they're not willing to love you. But if two people are willing to work, which if you go back to what our definition was, that's one of the key definitions for a healthy marriage. If two people are really willing to work, you can't not have a healthy marriage. And the trick is that when people have challenges with marriages, and challenges don't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be that you're sitting in marriage counseling, or it could be just that you're having a tough time, you know, that week you're annoyed. So I want you to know it's a very good example, because one of the greatest gifts to put into a relationship, to build a healthy relationship, is to decide, you know what, I'm not going to wait for the other person to start doing the giving. I'll start doing the giving. Now, how you give is a fascinating thing. Sometimes a person gives, you know, a teenager, the greatest gift that you give to a teenager, this is my sense, I'll tell you in a few years, is space. There is no greater gift that you can give to a teenager than space. Space, respect, that takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work to know how much to give and how not to give, but this will get us off on another tangent. We have to stop.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.